Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. My name is Alexander Starr. I'm the History Project Student Coordinator. Today we are speaking with Dr. C.V. Chen of the LLM class of 1969. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Chan Wen Chen. I was admitted to the LLM project of the law school of UBC in 1968, two semesters from 68 to 69. Ever since I got my Master of Law from UBC, I went on to study at Harvard Law School for 3 years. And after finishing the 3 year study at Harvard with an SJD degree, I went back to Taiwan to teach and to practice and to participate, among other things, other pro bono projects ever since 1968, and plus Cambridge, time in Cambridge, Boston, 4 years, which means I have been back to Taiwan ever since 1972 until today. So in sum, ever since 1968, which I was admitted to UBC Law School, it has been 48, 49 years. That's me, C.V. Chen, Chan Wen Chen.
Were you the first in your family to study law?
Yes, I am, fortunately or unfortunately.
what was your parents' profession?
Actually, my father was a soldier, or was an officer in the army with the nationalist government of Republic China. We called it Republic China then. That's my father's profession. And that was in 1949. The nationalist government and the communist government was having a riff or fight, as we read the history, we would know. And my father, as I say, was with the army, and army, of course, was with the nationalist government army then. The communist apparently had a problem with the nationalist government, and they fought each other, and mainland, that is Chinese mainland, was fall into the hands of the communist in 1949. And my father, together with the armies, in a way, was defeated by the communists. The government retreated to Taiwan from mainland China. And my father actually took my mother and my brother and sister and myself, four of us, with my mother, five, together with my father, and back into Taiwan. And my father was no sooner after we were settled in Taiwan in a rush, and he was again being ordered by the government to go back to China. And he fought the last battle, and he actually died in the battlefield. So you ask, what did my father do or my mother do? My mother was really a housewife, and she brought us up ever since my father died when I was only 5 years old. I was born in China, 1944. And my father, as I say, just lost his life. And my mother just raised me and my brother, sister, elder, up. And my mother actually was housewife, and ever since then. And she passed away about 13 years ago, 2004. Mm. Yeah, that's my family background.
I'm so impressed your mother raised
almost great mother. But that was what that was life.
An interesting start. And then you studied your first law degree in Taiwan.
National Taiwan University.
Yeah. And you lecture there now.
I lecture in another two universities, but not my alma mater. But Taiwan is very small.
Yes. So, you had your first law degree from National University of Taiwan.
Yeah.
And then you studied your LLM at UBC.
Yeah.
Why did you choose UBC?
I think why did I choose ABC? UBC, maybe we should, maybe the question can be rephrased by saying that, why UBC Law School?
Yes.
Admitted me. And I wanted to find out. Of course, I did apply, among others, UBC Law School. And UBC Law School was the university or the law school admit me, not only admit me, but also gave me a scholarship of 2,000 Canadian dollars in 1968. Quite an honor.
Yeah.
So I was most grateful. That's Imagine a young boy
yes.
from Taiwan.
And it was your was that your first time going so far away from
68, yes, of course.
Yeah.
That was I actually when I was at UBC, I think I was about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. 22 years old, maybe. Yeah, average, because I spent 4 years at a college yes. in Taiwan, obtained my BA in law, as a matter of fact. We don't call this LLB, mm-hmm. but it's a BA in law. So it was UBC admit me, not me chose UBC.
We're admitted to UBC, and do you remember anything about studying here in the late 1960s?
Actually, you asked a good question, because first of all, the memory is such a strange thing.
Yeah.
And I really don't think I got good memory. I couldn't even remember how my father looked like. I cannot remember all the things as I ought to. Peter Allen Law School, as I just saw it for the first time, ever since, looks very different, at least from the law school I ever attended 48, 49 years ago. But about the law school, what I remember, first of all, I certainly remember Professor Charles B. Baum, C.B. Baum. He was my professor teaching international law. And he was also my thesis supervisor. And he suggested the subject of my thesis, which, of course, I remember because I wrote the thesis under his supervision, entitled Microstate, or the position or the unique status of microstates. Apparently, in those years, when I attend the law school at UBC, straight away from National Taiwan University, apparently, I study, of course, public international law at the university in Taiwan, but I was not really introduced, or at least I was not aware of the issue of what Professor Baum led me to mm-hmm. understand called microstates. And he introduced to me this subject by referring me to the mini states, like, for example, in Europe, like Liechtenstein, Andorra, etc., San Marino, for example. Mm-hmm. These were the memory I had, a fond memory I had from Professor Charles B. Baum. And he also, in the 60s, that was, of course, apparently after the formation of the United Nations, he also alerted me to the issue that is under the United Nations system, there is a mandate for the United Nations to make sure the former colony under, for example, the superpowers would have become independent, like you're talking about these Micronesia countries and countries in Africa and so on and so on. So. And then he alluded me to small countries, microstates, like a state called Nauru, for example, very, very small country, those kind of country, very, very small countries with the little population, to the best of my memory, this country could be with a population of no less than 10,000 or 20,000, or you just say 50,000, for example, a small territory. And then Professor C.B. Baum drew me drew my attention to the fact, for example, small state or microstate, because they're sovereign state means they are sovereignty. Sovereignty means a big country, small country, they are equal under the United Nations Charter. So he introduced me to the idea of one state, one vote, under the UN General Assembly, at least, rules. However, he also enlightened me to the fact that the reality of international politics may not be exactly, well, sort of in line with one state, one vote. And with Professor C.B. Baum's teaching or guidance and supervisions, and with me also being a professor or teachers at the law school, being a lawyers and being someone involved in all kinds of things, I can sort of extract from what he taught me like 50 years ago into what we call, what is reality, what is aspiration of rule of law. Coming back to the issue we talk about, say, microstates, and Professor C.B. Baum actually wanted me to understand that with the formation of United Nations, and went into a new era with a UN is the hope of the future. And it has really proven to us, UN has done a great job. But again, you and I sometimes puzzle, can UN do better?
Yeah.
That's something for the future. So I think I just want to respond to your question by saying, I certainly remember what Professor C.B. Baum taught me. Without his suggestion, I am certain I could not have come up with such a interesting subject. Another memory I had, I shouldn't really miss, Professor Joseph Smith. He actually was a professor of jurisprudence. What he taught me about jurisprudence, I couldn't really remember that well. But he did impress me so much in that I remember him quite vividly, even though I could not really remember how he looked. But he did impress me very much by saying something along the following line to me. I was referring to a young, sort of innocent. Innocent is also a synonym of ignorance. Ignorant young man from Taiwan, who, as I say, was sitting on the Security Council, having the right of veto, but that country was actually quite less developed than the other four countries, namely United States, like UK and France and Russia. Yes, Russia, I want to put it as at the last, because Russia was not too well-to-do then, but even though they are very powerful. But anyway, what I really want to say is Professor Joseph Smith, knowing apparently I, Chang Wen Chan, Chang Wen, I just give you, you just call me CV because it's easier, short, for foreign friend to address yes. me or to know me. But at the school, I think in those days, Professor Charles Baum and Joseph Smith may just call me by Chang Wen. Coming back, Joseph Smith, professor, and he say to me, he just say, you from Taiwan, correct? Yes. I say, yes. And he say, well, I'm not quoting him. I remember he was saying, referring to CV, you came from a country or from a community where the Confucianism was prevailing, which was indeed the case. And under the Confucianism, and your Chinese people, he was saying you got a good character for being filial piety, which means you normally, younger generation, will show obedience or love your ancestor, your parent, your grandparent. And this being part of the cultural, apparently Professor Joseph Smith was saying to me that was something positive, something good. So these two professors gave me such impression that I remember from day one until today and until maybe many, many, many years to come. And the other professors, I must admit, I must admit with guilt, that is, I couldn't remember. Not that they have not taught me. I'm sure they have taught me so much, but I just had something to do with my memory. Memory fails.
After finishing your LLM at UBC, you then were at Harvard, completing an SJD.
And LLM.
And another LLM, yes.
I don't know why Harvard asked me to do the LLM again. I never asked, but I think it's good because otherwise I would have stayed only 2 years at Cambridge and 1 year less, which was no good because I only wish I could spend, actually, instead of 3 years, I should have spent, say, 5-6 years, which would enrich my life. This is something I would sort of urge my students, actually. As I understand, their generation, the average life would be 100, whereas our generation could be like 80s, for example. They got more time. I would urge them to spend time away from home and learning and also making friends.
You got your LLM and your SJD. Was it more research in the same area about microstates, or were you studying something completely new?
I would not say completely new, but I did not really work on the microstate anymore. But of course, I still pursue my studies primarily in international law, public international law, and also private international law. We call conflicts of law.
So you have this extensive education in public international law and private international law. So, and now your practice is in transnational legal transactions that cross borders and are between different states. Do you recall any sort of interesting issues that you dealt with in your practice? Kind of interesting cases?
Yeah, they certainly are interesting cases. Let's put it this way. And right after obtaining this degree, I went back to Taiwan to teach at the law school. And ever since, I have been teaching ever since. After teaching in the first year or two as a full-time professor, I start continuously, as I mentioned, without interruption, teaching on part-time basis. I find that sort of arrangement most benefiting to me in my career as a teacher and as a practicing lawyer. Not only I would consider this arrangement beneficial to me, but equally beneficial to the students for obvious reason, because I can combine academic with practice, and student will at the same time learn from the professor who not only has academic sort of aspect of the law to share with them, but also the practical experience. On top of that, when I returned from the United States to Taiwan, I been doing teaching and practice at the same time, and I joined one of the law firm in Taiwan, and ever since then I've been with the firm Lee and Lee. Our firm is the largest firm in Taiwan, and also one of the best, if not the best. And when I say large, it has benefit in that if it is a large firm, you have many members of the firm who are doing a different sort of a type of practice. And a different type of practice will expose to a different type of law. So on the one hand, we are practice, say, for example, law of Taiwan, Republic of China. On the other hand, because of our client's relationship, and because of the requirement of the practice, and because of the globalization, and even though we specialize in laws of Republic of China, Taiwan, we, because of practice, we need to learn foreign law. And as I just mentioned, we're the largest firm. Yeah. And we have so many colleagues, and we can share, we can accumulate so much experience, so much exposures. And that is a tremendous, I would say, treasures to us as lawyers or as a student of law who are doing service to clients. In general, to join a firm, to teach, and this kind of combination make the life of a law student or a practitioner rich, and for which we are extremely sort of grateful, grateful to the client who pay us to do something we love so much. And this, I think, is also an important aspect of life. And as I just mentioned, I've been teaching. So I always, even in Taiwan and also in mainland China as well, I think teaching is something quite important for the law students to learn. And if the teacher were equipped with not only academic but also practical experience, and also teacher being remind of the importance or the aim or the purpose of education, I think you asked me about interesting cases. I would say this kind of practice, this kind of a life are interesting already. And life is interesting because the way we want to pursue our life, we have a purpose to serve, in the sense that if the purpose, the aim were are correct, and the tool and the way to achieve correctly are mapped, and every minute of the work we are doing will make sense not only to ourselves but also to the students and to the client. But I can just give you one very simple example. Canada is one of the, we call Anglo-American section legal system, correct? Mm-hmm. And Taiwan, actually, I would say 50 years ago, apparently so, but not today, not so much so. We call it a continental legal system, right? Right. For example, under the Anglo-American system, like the barrister and solicitor. I give you one example, in an interesting case being that is to say, one who learned public international law, one who learned conflict of law, one who also learned, for example, transnational legal system, all these courses being taught at UBC, at Harvard, mm-hmm. Me being attending these two law schools. One of the cases, like it happened only about, say, 5-10 years ago in Taiwan, one of our clients had a joint venture with their partners in mainland. It's not unusual. These two partners had a dispute. The dispute, they signed, for example, joint venture agreement with a dispute resolution clause referring the dispute ought to be settled by arbitration. For example, the arbitration was referred to the arbitration association, for example, in Hong Kong. Hong Kong Arbitration Association, as, for example, different from international ICC arbitration or arbitration in London, but the arbitration was supposed to be held in Hong Kong. Under the administration of the Hong Kong Arbitration Society, for example, or association. Mm-hmm. But these two parties, one party being a Hong Kong, mainland China party, and the other party being Taiwan party. These two parties have a dispute, and dispute ought to be settled and cannot be settled by amicable sort of a agreement. Mm-hmm. And then one party had no choice but to, for example, initiate arbitration according to the agreement in advance in Hong Kong with the Hong Kong Arbitration Association. The Hong Kong Arbitration Association, I talk about Hong Kong. Hong Kong, as I just mentioned, being one of the Anglo-American legal system, with under the it's being accustomed to Anglo-American legal system, and arbitration, of course, is a mechanism being adopted by Anglo-American legal system and by continental legal system. This is not an issue, but rather the issue is what I just asked you: solicitor and barrister. Only until we render service to our client in Taiwan, and a issue interesting to me, these solicitors are solicitors. Solicitors are those lawyers who will meet the client, who will talk to the client, who will not, however, go to trial for the client. But when the dispute need to go to the court, it will be the function of the barrister. However, I understand the barrister would rarely meet with the client, but will meet the client only through the solicitor. Now I'm not talking about court cases, but I'm talking about arbitration.
Yes.
Right. It's interesting to me in that in the case we handle, and the choices, of course, would be we are counsel to the Taiwanese client. The Taiwanese client also has counsel in mainland because the case, the joint venture has to do with the mainland partner. But when, and also the governing law was the law of the People's Republic of China. So interpretation of the issues would really defer to the PRC law. Mm-hmm. But the client being a company in Taiwan, and the arbitration was to be held and conducted in Hong Kong, right? Mm-hmm. The question then is, the client need to retain not only the Taiwan lawyers, because it's a Taiwan company, and of course they would retain also the mainland, the PRC lawyers, because the law, the governing law is the PRC law. But arbitration, the place of arbitration is Hong Kong. And the contractors, the arbitrators, would be arbitrators selected by the arbitration association. They could be United States professor of law, or could be a U.S. practitioner lawyers. It could be anyone. The proposal or the issue was actually, would a barrister be a better choice to be the counsel for the Taiwan client, or a Taiwan lawyer could also qualify, or could a mainland China lawyer be qualified as the counsel for the Taiwan client at the arbitration in Hong Kong? One more cast. Hong Kong solicitor was also retained because the arbitration is to be conducted in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So Hong Kong solicitor supposedly know better about the procedures and so on and so on than a PRC lawyer and a Taiwan lawyer. So you see, there's so many parties involved. And I remember the arbitrators were, among others, there's three arbitrators. They were all really very renowned sort of lawyers or professors.
Yeah.
And they can, even though they don't speak Mandarin, of course, the translation is not a problem. But the questions, who shall be the counsel for the client at the arbitration proceedings? When we retain the solicitor in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong solicitor refer the client to a barrister. That was the practice, which is a normal practice of the Hong Kong solicitor. If they go to Hong Kong court for trial, it has to be a barrister in the way, if I'm correctly. But arbitration, because arbitration is a, even though it has the same sort of a function as a trial, which is something we call ADR, which makes sense because it's speedy, because it's confidential, because it's so. Because of the workload of the court too much. Everybody now advocates this is a good alternative dispute resolution. Then the role of barrister proves a little bit embarrassing to the Taiwan client, because the client wouldn't have the opportunity to meet the barrister. The barrister normally do not talk to the client directly, because the barrister in the old days, if not even today, they were speaking the same language as the judges. Unlike the solicitor, were speaking language like the client. And for that reason, it occurred to me, we were just saying, we, Lee and Lee,
yeah,
our partners, because We know Chinese. We speak Chinese. We speak Mandarin. We also can speak English. We can, even though we cannot speak English, we can eloquently present the case to with the help of the PRC lawyer. Because PRC lawyer being the lawyer of the law, which is the governing law of the joint venture agreement, for example. We have the confidence, perhaps, of the client much better, because if the barrister don't even meet the client, vice versa, the client would not really meet someone who will do the trial for him. They are lacking confidence. And how would they be sure that the barrister understand exactly what kind of problem the client was having, or the frustration of the client? I just want to draw one conclusion. The client finally agreed to our proposal, which is the following. You have the option to get either Li and Li as your Taiwanese counsel, who can work with efficiency, if not synergy, with the mainland Chinese lawyers for the purpose of understanding the governing law much better than anyone else. We now say this to you because of the unique role of barrister. Barrister normally do not meet with the client in trial. You have the option, either we will retain through the solicitor a barrister for you. However, you should understand the barrister would not talk to you as much as like the way that we know you, not only know you so well because we are all from the same city. We also know the case upside down, inside out. Now the barrister, they would only understand you through the solicitor. What would you like? And also we would tell the client, we can perform perhaps better. And the barrister, this is a case I just want to show you. It's interesting because it involves Anglo-American legal system, continental legal system. It's interesting in the case because it involves transnational legal problems. It's interesting because it involves client and attorney relations. This is one of the case. And the other interesting case, I think we're just trying to say transnational legal system or transnational law, and also for someone who learn or being taught, taught by a law professor at UBC, at Harvard Law, or at other law school, and also with experience of our own in different countries, we should really try to not only learn the uniqueness of the different jurisdiction, but rather we should find a common ground for the different jurisdictions.
And speak more about the charitable organizations you've been a part of. You were the president of the Red Cross for the Republic of China.
For 12 years, and also for a quarter century. Before I became the president, I was the secretary general. And that is the CEO of the Red Cross in Taiwan. That's one role I perform. At the same time, I also perform the role of the inaugurating CEO of a foundation called Cross Street Exchange Foundation, referring to a foundation set up in Taiwan by the government in early 1990s. Exchange Cross Street, referring to the Taiwan Strait. Taiwan Strait separate Taiwan from mainland. And you remember I talk about my father and so on. But of course, in the 90s, as opposed to the early 50s, and that was almost 50 more years, 60 years more later, Taiwan and China and Beijing start talking to each other. So the foundation was set up to make sure that dialogue can continue without government-to-government relations. Yeah, and I was the first term CEO of that foundation. And that is also one of the role I perform, pro bono role, and also perform other roles. For example, Red Cross has something to do with love and care. Like Henry Durand, the Swiss guy who formed the Red Cross together with his compatriot. That was in the 18th, 19th century, the Red Cross movement across the world. And of course, China, Taiwan, or mainland China, or Republic China, in even in Qing Dynasty, and this international movement, NGO, was already introduced into China. And as I just mentioned, I was the CEO and the president. That was only in the 90s and had something to do with the exchange of the family visit from Taiwan to mainland, mainland to Taiwan. As I just mentioned, Taiwan and mainland were separate in the 1949-50s when nationalist government was defeated by the communists. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, communist Taiwan, communist China, and the rest of the world actually were in different block. And the Soviet and China, they were, the communists and the Korean War and so on and so on. But the Cold War was over and they would start talking, and Taiwan was talking to mainland. At the same time, I was talking about, I was serving in the Red Cross, has something to do with the government again. The government had two things to do during those period, early 90s. Taiwan people start visiting mainland, their folks, their parents, and if they were young when they were in Taiwan, like my father, for example, who lost his battle in China, but if he didn't and he stayed in Taiwan, he was 40-something like that. And 40 and 50s, and talk about 1990, 50, and then he was 90 years old if he were alive. And he ought to go back to see his, well, parent, and parent must be already dying, all right? And if not, his brother and so on, so on, so on. So Taiwan in the late 80s, in the early 80s, opened the door for Taiwanese go back to China. And likewise, Chinese can come back to Taiwan. The Red Cross performed one of the functions. That is, they would trace, for example, where the lost parents, lost family were, and also exchange of letters, tracing the peoples and making sure that they were being properly taken care of. So, and I was doing my sort of a pro bono work while I was professor of law and also teaching ever since 1972. We'll talk about 90 already, 20 years later. And at the same time, I was saying that I was the inaugurating CEO of the Strait Exchange Foundation. That is more sort of a political than Red Cross. Red Cross is strictly neutral, neutral, neutral. But Strait Exchange Foundation has the mandate from the government in Taiwan to liaise with the government in mainland China in Beijing. When Beijing government and Taiwan government didn't want to talk to each other because they still were hostile to each other. Communist Party in Taiwan in the 90s, when I was the inaugurating CEO, was still considered as a illegal political parties. Yeah. You can imagine the case. So at the same time, I was performing these functions. And you may ask why I performed this function. First of all, I gave you the background of my father being officer of the army, and he was ordered to go back, and he lost his life no sooner, like 3-4 months after he took the family with the government to Taiwan. He went back and he died in the battle only within a month or two. And because of that, that was one of the reasons. And the other reason, with my family, you saw my daughter with the with her children, just very briefly. Yeah. She's now 42, 43. We have a boy who is now 35 years old. He was born mentally and physically handicapped.
Okay.
And because of disabled person, mm-hmm. so to speak, and 35 years ago, and this is 2017, we talk about 1990, when I was the Secretary General of the Red Cross. Within my family, we had this severely handicapped boy, and I realized how tough to have a family with a disabled person, mental, physical, if mental and physical, and they are in Taiwan. And so I can appreciate the hardship or the painfulness. And for that reason, when I was with the Red Cross, I say, why can't we do something more than what the Red Cross normally would do? As I say, the government mandate, we help Taiwanese go back to mainland, and mainland also coming to Taiwan to meet with their families, and this something that we can do. And we would do disaster relief, like earthquake in Japan, earthquake in Haiti, with the tsunami in 2004, for example, the South Sea tsunami, and the mainland Chinese Wenchuan earthquake, and the Red Cross, we mobilize funding and relief, and these are the things. But as I just mentioned, in the 90s, and I because of my boy, 35 years old now, and at that time he was young, like 8 years old, for example, mm-hmm. and I just through the Red Cross, we, for example, would say we would just raise fund to help the disabled person and particularly their families. Not only raise fundings for them for obvious reason, but also through, for example, marketing, that is education, through TV and magazine and broadcasting. You can see that was, as I mentioned, 30, 40 years ago. And people would look at the handicapped people with a difference of perceptions. These are strange peoples.
Yeah.
So through education, and people would realize, huh, okay, this happened to everyone, not only to those who perhaps a family did something bad in their early lives. Mm-hmm. This is the sort of a mentality change. And the other part, of course, funding so that we can help the parents. Sometimes the parents are from a not so sort of affluent families, and with the handicapped children added to their hardship. So if we can just raise enough fund through professional help, so we can just give stipend to these parents, they can just form club, and the parent can get together, and we can get professional to give them, say, a professional sort of advice how to do something like early detection, early sort of a rehabilitation, which make a lot of difference for their future life. And even now, I want to say something I gave you, like the Taipei European School.
Yes.
It all has something to do with, for example, my little boy, who is now 35 years old. When he was young, through the Red Cross, we raised fund. We call it love. Let love overcome obstacles. Love overcome obstacles. Story of love. We raise fund, and our client, being, say, parents, expatriate, European parents, they have their boys or girls at the British school, and being our client. And now I wear the other hats, being the CEO or being the vice president or the president of the Red Cross. I say, we need funding. And one of the parents come to me, he say, CV, I know you're doing this campaign, a very meaningful campaign. I have $200,000 NT. Do you want it? 200,000 is around like $10,000 okay. US dollars. I think it's good. I say, certainly. I think, thank you so much. She say that you have to come to lecture to the kindergarten students about Henry Duran. You know Henry Duran,
yes, the father of the Red Cross movement.
I say, certainly, I would do that. And once I have done this lecture with the kids, when I walk out with the parents who gave me the money, she told me that, and I say, well, how's the facility, et cetera, et cetera. She said, the facility we rented from a certain organization, and the lease will expire soon. She said, not only the lease will expire with the kindergarten, we have a primary school, we have another lessor with a different lease, which is also due to expire. This is a British school in Taiwan, you know, foreign investment. She told me that they also the French school, the French parent will have the same problem. They lease with different lessor.
Yeah.
The lease will expire. And there is a German school as well. So I only realize, on the one hand, I'm being the lawyer. Many of our clients from UK, from French, from German, and the parent being expatriate. the parent, they will come to Taiwan to do business in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. They have family. The family kids need to go to school. Without school, the parent would not be able to come, right? So it's very logical. For me, I only feel ashamed. I call my friends who in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I say, Mr. So-and-so, today I had this problem. And they say they have 3 or 4 or 5 different leases with a different date of expiries. I say, these are the expatriates. Expatriate client, we welcome foreign investment into Taiwan. Yet at the same time, we are not helping them. I think this is very bad. So my friend say, CV, give me 1 week. And 1 week later, he called me. He say, CV, there's an American school in Taiwan. The Americans, a little bit sort of close to Taiwan.
Yeah.
In that sense, American even had treaties with Taiwan then.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the TAS, Taipei American School, had just been relocated. The facility they use is vacant now. Do you think the European friend could use the facility? I say, let me ask. And all our European clients from the UK, I said the British school, the French school, and the German school, for the first time, they say, certainly, because we can then use the facility under one roof, even though they share costs differently. They manage the school sort of still with 3 different systems, but at least they have the facility under one roof. They have no lessor, because this is government let them use almost for free, only that you would pay for your electricity and so on. So this is the origin. And then 5 years later, the government, even at the time, day one, government say, this is for your use, but you better search your own facility, all right? But expiry come and go. 3 years soon expire. And same problem comes. The government want to take the land back. I call the government again. I say, 3 years ago, you gave this facility, but 3 years now, they still have this need. What do we do? And the minister say to me, give me 1 week. And 1 week later, he called me. He say, CV, different person. And he say, up on the mountain, we have a piece of land. We don't need to make use of the land, at least for the near future. Ask your foreign friend, our foreign friend, if they want to use the land to build their own facility, so that the lease can be 20 years renewable, but you build your own facility. I ask them, they say, wonderful. So we will lease the land, but the law says the land, government land, can only be leased to the Taiwanese or the nationals of Taiwan, or a foundation set up according to the law. A foundation set up according to the law of Taiwan, that is a Taiwan national, you know, natural person or legal person. We call company, we call foundation. So the European expatriate community say, CV, let's set up a foundation. They raise the fund, minimum fund like 10 million NT, which easily raised.
Yeah.
And we set up a foundation. The foundation set up, they need a chairman. The chairman, by law then, has Taiwanese. To be a nationalist government, nationalist. A Chinese national, and me, of course, would be the national. So I became the chairman of the foundation. So that is the Taipei European School now. Once the foundation set up, the 3 school, not only under the same roof, they built their own roof, their own facility. The 3 school made a decision to abandon their respective sovereignty, so to speak.
Yeah.
They merged 3 school into 1 school. We call it Taipei European School. I'm the chair. And also we have other sort of local and Taiwanese. And also the law changes now already. Foreigner can also be the chairman, could be the party, could be the board members. So this is another story I gave you. So we have 3 at least pro bono work. And also I also teach us.
Yes.
For example, not only in Taiwan, different law school, I lecture at a different sort of on all kind of occasions to introduce transnational law, and also I lecture in Beijing, in Shanghai, in Hangzhou, in China. For what reason? For reason has something to do with the fact that my father lost his life in the battle. For what? For perhaps no other purpose. Maybe but peace. But the peace was not earned easy, isn't it? But the peace, well, over 30, 40 some years, and the foundation, the Street Exchange Foundation, was founded in 1991. So 1991, 49, about 40, 50 years. Hmm? And we talk about now, already 60, 70 years. Hmm? So I kept, I was quite active teaching in China at the law school, less at the law school than at the management school, like the Beida and the Qingda and so on. Why? I want to teach them not only the modern sort of management law, business and law, business and law, but also at the same time wanted to really to share, exchange opinions with our friends in Beijing, in China, about what is the meaning of rule of law, and also even to share with them how Taiwan has been transformed from rule by law into rule of law. Remember one thing, when my father died, when my father with the government moved to Taiwan, Taiwan was under martial law. Martial law meaning one party ruled the country, the Nationalist Party. But the Nationalist Party was replaced by PTT, by DPP, called Democratic Progressive Party. Hmm? You probably remember, yes, if you ever heard, that was in year 2000. Hmm? And first time, the Nationalist Party lost their control, lost their sort of a power. Ever since, they were defeated in 1949 by Communist Party. They were again defeated, but now through democracy in Taiwan. So Taiwan rule of law started from, I would say, not to year 2000 when the National Party lost their election, but earlier in 1987, exactly 30 years ago. Exactly. 30 years ago, Taiwan became democratic country in a legal sense. Ever since then, formational party, political party is free. Anyone can form. And everyone can believe in different ideologies. Even communists could form a party in Taiwan. And freedom of press has become a reality. Unlike in China, for example, you cannot form your own medias. Still not now. So this is what I want to say to you. I've been active, hoping that this being a possibility. Yes. So, and peace and law, we just talk about, and rule of law has something to do with the fact that my father would die with a reason, I hope. And I certainly think mainland China, now the second largest economy in the world, they are most powerful country in the world, isn't it? And I think, what do you enjoy about teaching? About teaching primarily business and the law. 26 some years ago, China was very, very less developed, right?
Yeah.
But in terms of the political structures, Communist Party has been still very dominating. Mm-hmm. Dominating the success has something to do with the fact that they were the party.
Yes.
But lack of perhaps the true sense, what we call rule of law, also has something to do with the fact that Chinese Party was the dominating party. What advice will you be law student who might be listening to this interview? I would say it takes time. But maybe from the day one, if you can, first of all, by luck, you by luck being admitted, I by luck being admitted, fortunate enough, and for which we should be grateful. And also on day one, by luck, I met Professor. And I met Professor not only here, but also there, and also in Taiwan, and also for which we are also grateful. And then being a law student in a general sense, be you a lawyer or practitioner or a teacher, always make sure one thing, that is, don't worry about your life, and you will earn your life for sure. You will make your family survive and doing it with a good life. But on the other hand, we should always make sure that we are there not only for our own. We should be feel very blessed that we are being lucky. And for that reason, we should strive to do things that we can do for the betterment of other people. And knowing the world and also be conscious of things that you can do, I think that is important. And one person I like to cite for our student's reference is that there is a professor, I don't think he taught me, but he was a graduate from Harvard Law School. He says something, his name is Elliot Richardson. He served among other positions during the Nixon administration of the United States government as the Attorney General. And he was the Attorney General, and he actually was the guy who appointed Professor Archibald Cox as the special counsel to investigate Watergate incident. And I would not repeat what he did. Elliot Richardson, when he was a high school graduate, he say something which was recorded on the yearbook. He say what he intend to do in the future, and indeed he did. He passed away about 10 years ago at age of 90 or 95. Very distinguished gentleman. He say, I want to be, what do you intend to do in the future? He say, politics. Then he say, politics, if pursued conscientiously, is the most difficult of arts and the noblest of professions. I want to share with my fellow students of younger age, listen to what Elliot Richardson say. Politics was his choice. Law could be our choice. Lawyer could be our choice. Law professor could be our choice. Or business could be our choice. Any of your choice. Follow the same thing. Say, for example, law. If pursued conscientiously, so conscientiously pursuing something, if you do that, then this profession will be the most difficult of arts. Most difficult for arts, we have to toss around. It really takes years to learn what does it mean. Most difficult of arts. Only if you do it conscientiously and you learn what are the difficult of arts. Be a nice person or be a strict person. Be a person of principle. These are really not easy, but if you can master that, it will then become the noblest of professions. Thank you so much.